This is The Crisis Point. Welcome to The Crisis Point podcast, where, like Chesterton, we discuss nothing except for politics and religion, because, well, there's nothing else to discuss. I am Michael Warren Davis, the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. I am joined by my co-host, Philip F. Lawler, the director for the Center of the Restoration of Christian Culture at the Thomas More College of Liberal Arts. And just a quick note to our listeners before we get into our first topic. The Crisis Point podcast is now available on all major podcast hosting sites. So if you have Apple iTunes, if you have Google Podcasts, if you have Stitcher, Spotify, we're there. And if you listen to podcasts on the go, then go to your favorite podcast hosting platform and you'll find us. Just type in The Crisis Point. Our topic for today is the bombshell decision the Supreme Court handed down in Bostock versus Clayton County, Georgia on Monday. And what it essentially did was declare that the historic Civil Rights Act of 1964 will now extend not only to matters of race, but will also extend to matters of sexuality and quote-unquote gender. So effectively, you cannot be fired for being gay or transgender or any of those sexual identity politics issues. And if there is any hint that you may have been fired for these lifestyle choices, then you can sue. You can sue under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And as we know, when it comes to identity politics, the employer virtually never wins. So Phil, we know why this is a problem. Why don't you take it away?
Well, it's a problem for several different reasons. It's a problem because of the public policies that will come out of it, which will undoubtedly include affirmative action for homosexuals, for transgender. It will undoubtedly include false accusations and false claims. At this point, there are people suggesting that everybody should go right now and tell your employer that, you should tell your employer you're gay, because that way, if he ever decides to fire you because you're incompetent or you're goofing off, you can claim it's discrimination, whether or not you're gay. What possible test would be used to back up that claim?
It was very easy when the Civil Rights Act was first passed in 1964. It was very easy to determine who was black and who was white because it's a matter of skin color. Whereas for the most part, you have no idea what people are doing in their private life. I mean, as you say, I could just say I was gay and there would be no way to prove or disprove it. In fact, if you're not already in trouble with, Title VII lawsuits for firing an allegedly gay employee, the only thing that would make matters worse is if you questioned whether or not he was gay, and then you'd have the Twitter mobs after you and you'd probably have your business shut down. This is a very scary thing. And I think the ramifications for Catholic institutions and Catholic schools and things like that are particularly grievous, because as I wrote about in my article on this decision, what if one day a man named, Bob Brown, who's been teaching at a Catholic school for 10 years, comes to school one day and says, I'm now, you have to call me Babette, and I am now a woman. And, the school can do nothing about it. This Catholic school has to employ an obviously visibly transgender individual. And if they fire him for his new lifestyle, then the school can be sued, and Mr. Brown can say that his civil rights are being violated because the school won't refer to him as Miss Brown. Or what if a teacher, a male teacher, decides now to come out as gay, and he brings his male significant other to school events, and again, there's nothing that the school can do about that. The Catholic schools and institutions basically have to abandon any modicum of traditional sexual ethics when it comes to their employment practices, or else then, you know, these employees can sue under, you know, in the full weight of the U.S. Constitution will be behind them because of Bostock.
Well, that's absolutely true. And the only defense that a Catholic school would have is what's called a ministerial exemption, that if you classify the teachers in the Catholic schools as ministers, religious ministries, then that gives you a way to be exempt from the provisions of the Civil Rights Act. That will undoubtedly be tested, and I suspect that exemption will be whittled away into a very small corner of what Catholic schools do. But even if Catholic schools could be completely exempt, which they can't, even if they could be, there would still be ample reason for the church, for church leaders to speak out against this horrible decision, because it's wrong. And it's wrong to subject anyone, never mind whether the institution is operating under the auspices of the Catholic Church. If you're running a grocery store or a restaurant, you should not be required to testify to a lie. And that's really what's happening here. You know, you are going to be asked to call a man a woman, call a woman a man. That's a lie. Mm. And it's an offense against truth, which is a sin. In Bostock, you had six justices of our highest court signing their names to a lie. To me, that's the worst thing about this decision.
Yeah, and most of them Catholics. And I want to come back because there was one real surprise vote in favor in the majority on Bostock. But I want to just point out first, because something that you said sparked this in my mind. There was a Alexandra De Sanctis, who is a writer for National Review. I noticed that she's very good. I noticed that she wrote something about how, you know, it seems that we've actually kind of shot ourselves in the foot as social conservatives, because we've for the last, you know, 30, 40 years, we've been pursuing this, you know, this religious liberty angle. And, you know, we were all about matters of private conscience. And there's obviously something to be said about that. But what we didn't do is that we never argued, as you said, we never argued from the objective reality. For instance, that a man can't suddenly be a woman just because he decides that he is, or just because he feels like he is. The gender binary and, you know, quote unquote gender binary and biological sex are objective realities. And by saying, you know, well, transgender people, a man can dress like a woman if he wants to, as long as he doesn't force me to call him, you know, ma'am, then, you know, we've totally ceded the moral high ground and sold those really important scientific arguments down the river.
There is a history here of Catholic Church leaders defending Catholic institutions, saying, for instance, with Obamacare, that it would be terrible if Obamacare applied to Catholic hospitals and Catholic religious orders. Well, that's true. But what about individual Catholics who own secular businesses? Don't they also deserve protection? So that's my first point. My second point is, you made the point about sexuality being binary. The Civil Rights Act, as it was originally written and understood by the people who enacted it, and by the way, every single one of those people would have been appalled by this decision. As it was originally enacted, the Civil Rights Act applied to things that were written in your DNA. If you are African American, that's something you can't change. It's in your chromosomes. Mm-hmm. If you're a woman or a man, that's something you can't change. Now, the Gorsuch decision, the Bostock decision, turns that on its head, because it's now saying that you have chromosomes that show you're a man, but that is something you can change. So it's a completely different approach. Because, of course, the reason to argue against discrimination of the old, as it was once understood, is because you can't change your skin color. You can't change your sex. You can, however, change your behavior. And this is a decision that protects people on the basis of their behavior. against adverse comment. Well, some behavior is just wrong.
Some behavior deserves adverse comment. But it's unbelievable now that the law of the land in the United States holds that racism is no more or less reprehensible morally than homophobia and transphobia. These are now, we as a nation now officially say that to doubt whether a man can become a woman simply, again, because he feels that he's a woman, is now the, you know, the moral equivalent of saying that black people are inferior to white people. This, and it's extraordinary that this would, this historic piece of legislation has been tarnished this way, right at the same time that we have all of these protests across the country demanding equal justice for black people. Are people of color and are women not outraged that these, that the mantle of civil rights is now being extended to the tiny percentage of men who want to become women and the women who want to become men? It's astonishing. And what's more astonishing, and this is, I wanted to talk about the technical aspects of this case first, because they're important. They're the most important thing. This is a really dangerous piece of legislation. But the bigger point that's, I guess, getting more attention right now and also needs to be discussed is the fact that the majority decision was written by Neil Gorsuch. He didn't just vote for it. He wrote the majority decision. And despite being a Trump appointee and despite being, you know, a doyen of the Federalist Society, which is the, you know, the Republican Party's gatekeeper on legal and judicial issues, he wrote this hideous opinion that was, let me just read some of it. This is a quote from Neil Gorsuch. An employer who fires an individual for being homosexual or transgender fires that person for traits or actions it would not have questioned in members of a different sex. It is impossible to discriminate against a person for being homosexual or transgender without discriminating against that individual based on sex. It's just, Neil Gorsuch, a conservative, I think he used to be a Catholic, but is certainly a Christian, is completely obliterating the existence of biological sex. And here's another quote. He says that in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, quote, Congress adopted broad language, making it illegal for an employer to rely on an employee's sex when deciding to fire that employee. We do not hesitate to recognize today a necessary consequence of that legislative choice. An employer who fires an individual merely for being gay or transgender defies the law. End quote. So judicial activists always pretend that they're just they're just correcting or properly interpreting an existing law. And Gorsuch is pretending that this is, you know, that the Civil Rights Act has always basically forbade discriminatory hiring practices against transgender people, which is just a total fiction. Everyone knows that. Even the law supporters know that deep down. As you said, the people who passed that legislation were predominantly, you know, morally right-thinking people of their age. And homosexuality was still considered taboo in the 1960s, let alone cross-dressing. So whatever their merits, whatever side of the debate you fall on, that was not the intention of the legislators that passed the Civil Rights Act. That is judicial activism at its finest from the man who was supposed to be the successor to the great Justice Antonin Scalia.
That is really unsettling. That is in some ways the most unsettling thing about this decision. The notion that after all these years of Republicans promising strict construction and legal positivism and justices who would uphold the law as common sense dictates, that's not the result that we've had. You know, we've been saying this. This is actually a big political point, and it's not one that I'm happy to raise, but in the, what is it now, 47 years since Roe v. Wade, that we have had Republican presidents for most of that time, Republican nominees to the Supreme Court, and we've lost ground. And that's really frightening. And it's not just me saying this. I noticed today Robert George from Princeton, who is as solid a legal theorist as you're going to find in conservative circles, said on Twitter, and I quote, "The strategy I and others hoped would bring integrity to the courts by staffing them with judges who would faithfully apply the laws as written and not at as legislators can hardly be said to have been a success. Infidelity to principle has been rampant." You know, this has been a major campaign point for Republican candidates for most of my lifetime now, that you have to vote for us because we'll appoint the right judges. And let's face it, they have not delivered on that promise.
Not at all. Not one of them. We haven't had a real solid appointee since Antonin Scalia. And the real bitter irony is that, you know, it's not always obvious from the get-go that these people are going to betray the principles that they were appointed to pursue. Justice Kennedy was kind of a surprise when he ended up being more liberal than conservative. No one saw this coming with Gorsuch. I remember when he was nominated, there were Republicans practically, you know, dancing in the streets because they, you know, they had finally found the great successor to Antonin Scalia. I don't think anyone forgets the massive, massive battle over, you know, Donald Trump's nomination in the 2016 Republican primary, where, you know, the never Trump conservatives were saying, this guy is not a true believer. He does not believe in traditional marriage. He does not believe, you know, there's no, historically he has supported abortion, late term abortion. This is not a man that we can trust to represent our principles. And then there are others like me who I voted for Trump in the primary. There are others like me who said, you know, the politicians' integral principles don't necessarily matter. They are a vehicle for their voters, and as long as we can trust Trump to support legislation that we support and to appoint judges, and that was the big thing. As long as we couldn't cede the court to Hillary Clinton. As long as we could trust Trump to appoint good justices and to support good legislation, what his own private beliefs are basically ephemeral. And the sad thing is that I think Donald Trump really did mean to give us a great, solid, pro-life Supreme Court justice, someone who would overturn Roe v. Wade. And what he ended up doing was completely perverting the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah, and that's unsettling too, because Trump's record for judicial appointments is the best of the recent Republican presidents. It's better than Reagan. It's better than either Bush. He has not appointed a Kennedy or a Souter, or at least we didn't think he had. And throughout the federal courts, his nominations have been really very good. But there's something else going on here, which is just the trend in legal thinking, such that even the good jurists are pretty bad.
Yeah, and he didn't even err. This is the real kicker. Gorsuch didn't even err on the side of small government, which is, you know, that would have been my assumption. He strikes one as kind of a more on the libertarian side of conservative libertarianism. But he ended up being in favor of enforced morality, of, you know, state sanctioned anti-discrimination on grounds of, you know, sex and transgenderism, homosexuality and transgenderism. He was the last person I would have thought would have weighed in favor of enforcing the new moral orthodoxy that says that homosexuality and transgenderism are not only acceptable, but they're things to be celebrated. So that's it just came completely out of left field. Now, I'm not going to speak for you on this, Phil, but I've long, long, long been weary of the Federalist Society, because, you know, it's very often the Federalist Society appointed judges like Anthony Kennedy who end up screwing up there, you know, who end up, you know, betraying their principles. And this was, I remember, you know, I'm sure that you do too, that for a couple of weeks there was a big back and forth about whether Trump, for the second vacancy, Justice Kennedy's vacancy, whether he would nominate Brett Kavanaugh or Amy Coney Barrett. And the Federalist Society was gung-ho all in favor of Brett Kavanaugh because they said that Amy Coney Barrett would be impossible to get through because of her long track record of being aggressively pro-life and conservative as a in the judiciary. So we were told by the Federalist Society that Kavanaugh's, you know, basically total lack of, there was no evidence, there was no actual evidence that Brett Kavanaugh was pro-life or that he would vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. You kind of assumed it because he is Catholic and he has a family and he worked for the Bush administration, but he had basically had no experience on life issues. And this was supposed to be a good thing. And it was, of course, you know, that was a complete disaster. It was the worst nomination hearing in the history of the United States government. It was totally derailed. He was almost completely derailed. They almost lost that seat. But that was the Federalist Society's maneuvering. And I'm very weary of all of these conservative establishment groups in the Beltway. And I don't mean conservative establishment as in, you know, they're all voting for Mitt Romney over. I mean just people that have been in D.C. for a long time and have been overseeing the conservative politics, the conservative movement, have been sort of at the helm of the ship of conservatism for the last 40 years when, as you say, we've suffered defeat after defeat after defeat. And at what point do we say, you guys stink. You're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. So you're out. That's what Trump was supposed to be about. Trump was supposed to be about clearing out all the broken thinking, all the lame policies that don't work, that have been leading us to crushing defeats one after another in the culture wars. And because through things like nominating people like Neil Gorsuch, who are just snakes in the grass, pseudo-conservatives, who are climbing the ranks of conservative, the conservative judicial establishment, just so that they can get bigger jobs and bigger paychecks, but who don't believe anything that we believe.
Well, I guess I have a higher view of the Federalist Society than you do. I do think the Federalist Society has been instrumental in the appointments in the Trump years, and I think their influence has overall been very good. What I draw from this unhappy lesson is the moral of the story is, don't assume that because somebody is a Republican, because he's a nice guy, because he's gone to the right clubs and said the right things, don't assume that his judicial philosophy is going to be based on the natural law, a recognition of teleology and metaphysics. You can't assume those things anymore. You can't even assume it. Kavanaugh, as you probably noticed, Kavanaugh voted the right way on this one in dissent, but at the end of his dissent, he had a paragraph congratulating homosexual activists for all of the inroads they have made in the past generation. So that makes me worry as well. There's an awful lot of social pressure, and judges are subject to social pressure too. They're subject to pressure from the people they meet at barbecues and cocktail parties, from their old high school and college friends. And when the liberal academic circles are moving inexorably leftward, that puts a lot of pressure on all of these people.
This is what you get for having a Catholic judge who went to Georgetown. I'm not going to keep this bone with the Federalist Society, but Kavanaugh did vote the right way on Bostock. But I remember I was one of those who was very pro Amy. I don't know if you were, Phil. I was very pro Amy Coney Barrett. I still am. And I was furious when Trump decided to go with the safe establishment pick over the sort of the firebrand culture warrior, because that was what we voted for him to do. If we wanted our judges to be picked by the Federalist Society and things like that, we would have voted for Marco Rubio. But anyway, I'm not want to talk about the Federalist Society. I was skeptical of Kavanaugh because, again, he had no no record on pro-life issues. And then in his first major decision on anything to do with abortion, that was last October, in the case of Anderson versus Planned Parenthood of Kansas and Mid-Missouri. And I don't know if you remember the details of the case, Phil, but so the plan, there was evidence that the state of Kansas had evidence that Planned Parenthood was harvesting the organs of aborted fetuses, which is profoundly immoral as well as illegal, and therefore decided to cut off the funding that the state of Kansas pays to Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood sued, saying, "No, the legislation says that we get money. We're entitled to those taxpayer monies, and you have no right to withhold those funds." Unless you go through the proper channels, change the law, et cetera, et cetera. So this went to the Supreme Court, and Justice Kavanaugh did vote with Planned Parenthood. He voted to say that, yes, Planned Parenthood is entitled to monies from the state of Kansas, and that, you know, whether or not they were harvesting organs from unborn babies, from aborted fetuses, you have to go, the cash flow has to resume. The state of Kansas has to keep paying taxpayer monies to Planned Parenthood. It was outrageous. It was absolutely outrageous. I'm pleasantly surprised that he voted the right way on Bostock. But as you said, the end of his decision left this big hole, just basically a wink and a nod. You know, I might not be voting with you guys on this one, LGBTs, but I'm still your friend, and I'm gonna back you. You know, I'll be with you eventually. Just wait for the right case. So we really just don't have any friends on the Supreme Court. I mean, there's Justice Thomas, of course, he's terrific, but he's getting older too, and he, as you said, he's just, you know, because not only not only conservatism as a philosophy, but even, you know, the Catholic Church and Catholicism in this country has become so metaphysically and morally weak that even if someone goes to mass every day, has a big family, and calls themselves a conservative or Republican, you have no idea if their beliefs have any substance. They could just as easily be a Joe Biden kind of, you know, well, I'm personally opposed to abortion, but I'm not going to tell other people what to do. Or, you know, I wouldn't have sex with a man myself, but Jesus Christ says, judge not lest ye be judged. So I'm not going to, that's the kind of lame pseudo-conservative, pseudo-Christian squib attitude towards sexual morality. And that has become ubiquitous, not only in the Democratic Party, but in huge, alarmingly large swaths of the Republican Party as well.
You also have to understand that there are different types of conservative judicial philosophy. And Gorsuch claims to be a textualist. He claims that, and by the way, in that respect, he does follow Scalia, who was adamant that the court should not be making judgments about what's desirable in legislation, but rather what's constitutional in legislation. And if it's constitutional, then it's not the business of the justices to decide whether or not it's a good idea. That's the legislator's job. Well, but okay, so then you look at the language of the legislators and you ask yourself, what did they intend? And if you do that with the Civil Rights Act, as I said earlier, you must come to the conclusion that everybody in Congress in the 1960s, or rather nobody in Congress in the 1960s, thought that this provision applied to transgender people. That wasn't even a term that was used in the 1960s. Yeah. Members of Congress wouldn't know what you were talking about when you talked about sexual orientation. It just wasn't there. But Gorsuch invented it. And you used the phrase, I don't know if you used it intentionally earlier in our conversation here, you said that it's terrible legislation. And that's what it is. This is an act of legislation by the Supreme Court. And of course, you know, part of the story here is that Congress doesn't legislate much anymore. Congress lets other people make the rules, the president or the bureaucracies, you know, the regulatory agencies, where Congress has forfeited its own responsibility. And really, our only way out of this is for Congress to resume their own responsibilities and to take them back from the Supreme Court.
You mentioned the difference between textualism and their other philosophies, living, constitution, theory, etc. But you also made a really terrific point that I think needs to be repeated over and over, which is that it is a sin to lie. And regardless of the philosophy with which you approach the U.S. Constitution, a man cannot become a woman. It's not possible. It's contrary to nature and to reason. If your judicial philosophy allows you to say that a man can become a woman, then it is a lying philosophy. Your philosophy is pro a lie. And that is not conservative or liberal. It's just incorrect. It's just, it's wrong and it's wicked.
It is. And it's very frightening to think that now, according to our highest court, federal legislation must obey a philosophy that's based on a lie. Are you saying now that our regime is based on a lie because a regime that's based on a lie is doomed?
I just got an email from a colleague who works at another conservative magazine, and he said, this is vindication. He's not an integralist. He's not one of these Catholics who doesn't believe that the U.S. founding was a good thing. He's not a Habesian or a Deninian. But he wrote to me and he said, this vindicates the illiberal wing of the Catholic Church. This is exactly the decision that they've been waiting for one of the more allegedly sound, pre-approved, FedSoc stamp of approval justices to completely betray not only conservative principles or Christian principles, but scientific reality. We are now in a post-truth period, not only on the left, but on the right. There is a large swath of the right that rejects the basic reality that men and women are two distinct biological entities, and that doesn't change. So yes, you're right. This does, unfortunately, necessarily will call into question the legitimacy of the U.S. government for a lot of Catholic onlookers. And the arguments that are being made by, I shouldn't say anti-American, but, anti-constitutionalist, anti-founderist, guys like Patrick Deneen and Sarab Amari, who are saying maybe America was badly founded. This gives a lot of fodder to people like them. This could be a major turning point in the way that we understand the way that the U.S. Constitution and the three branches of government works.
That's right. It seems to me that this is a very important decision for that reason, that this here we have a decision that is based, well, I keep saying it, it's based on a lie. And so you have to ask yourself, are you willing to accept that lie as the basis for, as the price we pay for civic peace? And we've been asked this a couple of times in the past. We've been asked to do that with the Roe v. Wade decision. We were asked to do it with the Obergefell decision, where the court had rulings that are just in conflict with facts. Facts about when human life begins, facts about who's a man and who's a woman, facts about what marriage is. And the fundamental question that we have to ask ourselves, I suppose, is do we believe in objective truth, and do we insist that our constitution and our regime must be based on objective truth? Because if it's not based on objective truth, what is its base?
There's another window that's going to be opened here, I think. A lot of the rhetoric that is used by integralists like Adrian Vermeule is to say basically the left totally ignores the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution is effectively no longer in force. And so it only makes sense for the right, conservatives and others, to also drop the pretense, stop pretending like we're being ruled, governed by the U.S. Constitution, and embrace an activist government, embrace the power of the imperial presidency. And I guess in this instance you would say stop complaining about judicial activism, just create an activist judiciary, but from the right. Make sure that we don't need good textualists or originalists on the Supreme Court. We need actual conservatives who are going to, legislate from the bench, because that's the only chance. We can't stop the left from doing it except by doing it ourselves. And again, this is just another chapter of this protracted debate that we're having now. You know, do conservatives need to double down on the rhetoric about small government, you know, opposition to the imperial presidency, the activist judiciary, or do we lean into it? Do we accept this as a new political reality and accommodate ourselves and our principles to that reality? I don't know which side is going to win.
Well, that's maybe a good topic for another day, but I will say that what is clear to me is that we are going to have to start fighting our political battles on the basis of what's right and wrong, not just on the basis of procedure. Mm-hmm. This is something we said earlier about how, for instance, for Catholics, you can't say simply, this is a violation of my religious freedom, although that's true. That's inadequate. You have to say it's wrong. Yeah, you know, in the 1960s, when these civil rights debates were occurring, there was a very strong consensus that homosexual activities were wrong. How did we lose that consensus? We lost it because we didn't talk about it. We preferred to talk about procedural things. And I think that's one of the keys here, to have a politics that's based on truth.
That's a great place to wrap up. Well, thank you again for joining me, Phil. It's always a pleasure. And thank you all for tuning in. We'll see you again next week. Until then, I am Michael Warren Davis. He is Philip F. Lawler. And this is The Crisis Point. Thank you all very much, and God bless you.